From the Sky News Centre at 5, astronaut Tim Peake has become the first British person to walk in space. He's carrying out repairs on the International Space Station, as Simon English reports.
An historic moment for Great Britain as Tim Peake moves.
Major Peake and an American colleague are spending 6.5 hours fixing solar units and laying cables.
Tim, it's really cool seeing that Union Jack go outside.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be wearing it.
They're working in 45-minute blocks of daylight and then complete darkness as the station rotates around the Earth.
I'm doing good.
Fellow astronaut Luca Parmitano remembers his first spacewalk in 2013.
The view is absolutely outstanding. There are no words to describe its beauty.
There's a 25-minute cleanup and checkup when they re-enter the ISS.
Tim Peake, I think you got everything under control.
Six men have been taken to hospital in France following medical trials at a private clinic. One patient is thought to be brain dead, while five others are in a serious condition. 90 people received the experimental painkiller as part of a trial in Rennes. French Health Minister Marisol Touraine has met the victims and their families.
I won't hide this from you. These meetings were particularly emotional for me because, of course, they're incredibly distressed. The victims themselves, their families, and some of them, in fact, come from quite far away.
Legal proceedings against Lord Janna over child sex allegations have been formally dropped following the 87-year-old's death last month. A peer and his wife have been tied up during a raid on their country home. £700,000 worth of heirlooms were stolen from Goodwood House in West Sussex, home to Lord and Lady March. And a village in Pembrokeshire has endured 81 consecutive days of rain, thought to be the longest spell of wet weather in the UK since 1932. Hasn't stopped raining in Eglwys Saroo since October the 26th. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
BCFM 93.2.
Yes, it's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, charged with keeping London's financial district safe from terrorists, and with this week's announcement of a doubling of armed anti-terror officers patrolling the streets of the capital, wouldn't you have hoped the City of London Police Counter-Terrorism Command were up to the job? What if they were fitting innocent Londoners up as terrorists to justify their existence, or using the veil of national security to take bungs from private security firms, to lie in court and to burgle victims' homes when they got found out? Well, this is what happened to plumbing firm boss Ian Puddick when he telephoned a powerful city firm asking for his wife to be moved from working with a manager who'd been having an affair with her. Suddenly, he was a terrorist, his home was illegally raided, and a bout of police bribery and corruption that nearly destroyed his business. It's taken Ian years to fight back against the crooks at the Counter-Terrorism Command. Gang of criminal masterminds, a private security firm called Kroll. He's fought them through the courts. And the city's good old super rich elite merchant venturers, not the City of London, that's the Bristol City this time, owning and running utility companies, hospitals, youth services and schools. And Mayor George Ferguson was a merchant venturer too. Have they taken over? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. But onto our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. I think it's one of the first times we've talked about minus temperatures this, during this winter, actually. Lows of -1 Celsius tonight, dry but icy in the early hours, highs of 7 Celsius this weekend, sunny on Saturday, mainly cloudy though on Sunday, but feeling cold, icy at night. So if you want to get out and about, do it tomorrow, forget the shopping. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, warming up a little bit, wet and windy at times, more sunny spells midweek. Next weekend, that's the 23rd and 24th of January. Highs of 10 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Easton, Afzal Shai. Hi, Afzal. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, it's a pleasure being back on.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Afzal. You're relatively new to the City Council, aren't you? When were you first elected?
I was elected just over 2.5 years ago, and here I am in Easton Ward, even in this studio. It is part of my ward, and it's an absolute privilege to represent the good citizens of this area.
So tell us about your background. Where have you come from to become a councillor?
I've been involved in community affairs pretty much all my life. Since the age of 19, I was involved with different initiatives in terms of lobbying in London on human rights. And also, I was a lay custody visitor, holding the police to account.
Yes, I did that as well for a while. Quite interesting, isn't it? Going in, doing surprise visits to the police custody cells to make sure people were being looked after. And maybe you could tell us, do you have any stories from that?
Certainly. I mean, there have been cases where there was one particular case where a young female felt she was quite badly treated. She wasn't given the opportunity to contact a solicitor because she'd already spoken to a family member, and they said that you can't make another phone call. She wasn't given access to halal food. And one of the saddest things, actually, that became quite apparent is the number of people who were actually locked up in police custody suites when actually it was more an issue about mental health. It was a real, real tragedy. So it wasn't one case, it was numerous cases. And it's just trying to ensure that police officers, custody sergeants, that they do behave within the law, and that they treat everyone as an individual, as opposed to just thinking that because people have been arrested and brought into the custody suite, that they are automatically guilty.
Now, I wonder, I don't know if you've seen the film or the book about the Stanford Prison Experiment, but that was an experiment done in the Stanford University in the United States. I think Martin's probably familiar with that, where over a summer holiday, an experiment was done, really, to see how people who were had others in custody would treat them when there were varying degrees of supervision. Martin, this is actually something interesting about human psychology here, that if the accountability is not there, sometimes with rogue groups of people could be actually really punishing people and actually taking out some of their own personal problems on those who they're supposed to be guarding, looking after.
Well, I can't remember all the details of the Stanford experiment. I think they were actually encouraged to take a harder line. And I think there's another experiment, isn't there, where they people are administering electric shocks, which are not actually injuring the person.
Well, the Stanford prison experiment, if we can stick on that, actually had to be closed down because people were, some quite a nasty sight of human nature can come out when there isn't enough accountability, Afzal.
Absolutely. And one of the local cases, I say local, it was in Wiltshire, when a police officer actually dragged a female female individual who was arrested, and he dragged her out by her hair, and he actually started attacking her. He actually got the sack in the end, but had that not been captured on CCTV, it may not have gone to court. So I think it's very important that as citizens that we do hold our statutory agencies to account.
I mean, that's a voluntary thing you've done, but what about professionally?
Professionally, yeah. So we've had family businesses. I've worked in family businesses. So we've got a couple of retail businesses, shops, also a taxi office. I've also worked in providing private retail sector organisations in-house training for MVQs and apprenticeships. However, I do feel that there is a bit of an issue there in terms of delivery to inner city areas. So that's the field that I've been working in. But also, I represented 223 families when they were burgled, and they felt that the police wasn't taking them seriously. Some of them had aggravated burglaries. It was a number of individuals targeting mainly Asian households for gold burglary in Bristol. I mean, that's a very significant number, 223 households, to tunes of millions of pounds, where the gold was actually being sold in Birmingham at the gold exchange, and some of it was actually being smuggled to the Asian subcontinent. So I've always tried to hold the local constabulary and the local council to account. In fact, recently I held Mayor Joyce Ferguson to account with the debacle over the Walmart Bristol scheme. So there's about £6.5 million invested in that scheme, and people were left without repairs, left without heating, left with windows that I needed repairing. So it was most unfortunate. But
so just tell us a bit more about the scheme. I mean, the idea was the city council were paying for people to have insulation, isn't it?
Yes, it was essentially that. It was quite an ambitious scheme, and one that I definitely welcome. It was piloted in Easton. However, the lack of due diligence meant that they awarded the contracts to companies that weren't based in Bristol. So there were companies coming down from the other side of London, there were companies coming down from Newcastle, and because of some of the... Because it was awarded to the cheapest contractors, it meant that, as far as those individuals were concerned, they were just going to do a cheap and nasty job, move on, because Bristol's not their home turf. And I did ask the mayor that in future, any such scheme, where possible, we should try to give first refusal to local contractors.
Did you ask him about the port sale? Because we have been discussing that over the last couple of weeks. Again, I mean, this was last year, I know, but 2,500 acres of prime industrial land right next to the port. Is that really only worth £10 million?
It really does beg a belief. Why the tendering process didn't, for example, include some of the Chinese sovereign wealth funds or the Arab sovereign wealth funds from Qatar or Saudi. I mean, these kind of organisations, I'm sure, would have put in hundreds of millions potentially. I mean, £10 million for 2,500 acres does sound absolutely preposterous, but it seemed like it was a done deal. And certainly at full council, the mayor just smiled. As far as he was concerned, it's all done, and he felt, to use his own words, it was good value for money. And what I would say is,
well, good value for money for who?
Well, exactly. Perhaps for the friends of George Ferguson, perhaps. That's a question which we need to ask. But he will be coming to City Academy next week, and I think that people need to certainly ask that question of him.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this could be described as corruption, possibly not fraud, because that land is worth a lot more than £10 million. Everybody seems to agree on that.
Well, I don't know that much about
this. 2,500 acres of industrial land.
I would say that it strikes me as very convenient that there's now £9 million in the budget for George Ferguson to be Santa Claus with between now and May. And, of course, that it's only at the margin that will make a difference. But from his point of view, you could argue, I mean, that land could have been kept in the hands of the city council and developed, or, as you say, could have been sold for a lot more money.
I've noticed,
I think, local government all over the country is being forced to sell assets in order to keep current expenditures up. And that's the same as what's happened with Greece and all these other any subdivision of which is under pressure from above to make austerity cuts, then is tempted to sell the family silver, as it were, just to keep the show on the road.
How about using that 2,500 acres to actually develop some households, some affordable housing?
Well, indeed. I mean, you're on the council, AFSEL. You will know better than I what the issues are. But it strikes me that the pressure on local... I was reading somewhere that at the end of the process that the last government and this government have gone through, local authorities will have 25% of the resources that they had at the beginning. and that puts enormous pressure on them just to get rid of assets, just to keep basic services running.
But you see, actually, George can do what he wants. That's what he was elected to do what he wants. BBC this time last week was reporting Bristol Mayor George Ferguson denies the slur of being a dictator. Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson said he will be more consensual should he win a second term in May's election, has denied being dictatorial. He told the BBC he had taken flak for his residence parking zone, and successful cities had to be prepared to make brave decisions. He was elected as an independent in 2012. Other candidates selected so far to fight for to be mayor are Labour's Marvin Rees, who came second in 2012, Lib Dem Kay Barnard, Conservative Charles Lucas, and Green candidate Tony Dyer. And we'll be hearing from another candidate, independent candidate, Christine Townsend, a little bit later in the show. But, I mean, citing the RPZ is actually not one of the most controversial things he's done, Afzal, is it?
Not necessarily, but I think the issue here is about the democratic deficit. And as far as people are concerned, George likes to talk about some of his successes, and no doubt that he'll be talking about the arena. He'll be trumpeting that as one of his successes. But there's the lack of consultation there in terms of parking facilities. If you also look at the fact that he brought in the 20-mile-per-hour zones, spent £3 million on road signs for the 20-mile-per-hour zones in Bristol. And then what does he do? The first thing that he does is gets caught speeding himself coming down the portway. So if you lead by example, I think this is the wrong way to actually go about it. And I actually voted for a mayor several years ago, but with George Ferguson's record and the lack of perceived democracy.
Why did you vote for a mayor? What was the reason?
I wasn't too sure at the time, but having spoken to a number of my candidates, I thought, okay, let's be brave here. Let's give it a try. And I feel that, certainly with George Ferguson's model, that's been a complete failure. I mean, it is good that he's come to City Academy, for example, with the mayor's question time, but where was he for the last 2.5 years? All of a sudden, he wants to come to...
Well, he's fighting an election now, isn't he? Why is Marvin Rees standing again? Because he stood in exactly the same capacity against George Ferguson in 2012 and lost. So why on earth is Labour picking the same person to fight the same battle? Surely they're just going to lose again.
No, I think personally, I think it's fantastic Marvin Rees is actually running. It's just goes to show that, you know, I feel that he's a symbol of hope, that somebody who's been raised in a council estate in Lawrence Weston and then moved to Easton.
But you missed my point. He lost last time.
He may have lost last time, but...
No may about it. He did lose.
No, I mean, because he did lose last time, but it was very close, actually. If you look at second preferential votes, it was a lot closer than people think. And I think if you look at the relatively low turnout first time round, people weren't too sure what to expect. And I think anybody who needs a reason now to come out and vote for Marvin, all you have to do is just look at George's record. So I would say, people, please wake up and make sure that you do come out to vote this year. And I think that there will be a much greater turnout, because it's also the all-out elections for councillors as well.
Well, staying with the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn's appointed Bristol MP Thangam Debonair to the Labour front bench this week. That is despite the fact that she's currently undergoing radiotherapy treatment in the city while she recovers from breast cancer. Now, as I understand it, she actually has recovered. The cancer is gone and she's getting ready to return to Westminster. Despite that, Labour leader Mr Corbyn appointed her Shadow Minister for Culture, Media and Sport on Thursday. However, her office said the leadership accepted that it would be a while until she can devote a substantial amount of time to the role. Martin, this almost smacks of desperation from Jeremy Corbyn. He's scrabbling around for left-wing MPs. Thangam's only just been elected and he's trying to put her in charge of Culture, Media and Sport. He doesn't seem to have a lot of left-wing MPs to choose from, does he?
Well, I think that's a very negative way to talk about this. We've now got two Labour MPs in Bristol. Kerry's Shadow Secretary for Rural Affairs, and Thangam, who's got a thumping majority at the last election, has been chosen to be the front. What it shows is that the Labour Party is actually in a process of change, reconfiguration, and new blood is being brought in. I think it's great news for Thangam.
I mean, normally
it's
you
also
would,
great
normally
news
that
she's getting better.
Okay, you would normally only join the front bench as a spokesperson, opposition spokesperson, if you've been elected a couple of times before.
Well, Varoufakis was brought in to run the whole of economic policy in Greece, having never been a politician at all, just parachuted in as finance minister. That's the future. The old jobs for the boys and girls way of running politics, that's going to be blown out of the water by the economic crash that's coming.
Well, and also, of course, the Conservatives do bring in people, just make them lords, and suddenly they're sitting in the cabinet after that, aren't they?
Yes, but before I address that, I think it's fantastic. I mean, there are a few great announcements made by Jeremy Corbyn. One is Thangam, and I think it's fantastic that we've got a female member of the BME community who's in a very significant position there. And I think when you say that, you know, that Jeremy Corbyn is looking for a left winger as well, Thangam is not a left winger.
Well, she's been supporting the nationalisation of the railways. That's fairly left wing.
It is, but I think to actually, you know, pigeonhole someone and say that they're left wingers, I think that Thangam's record speaks for itself. That she's a champion for the people of Bristol, and somebody who's worked very hard within the Labour Party, and I feel that that her energy and determination has been recognised. But also Imran Hussain, the Bradford West Member of Parliament, he has been appointed the Shadow Secretary for International Development, and I think that is fantastic. You're getting talented people from the BME community coming forward. I think that if that doesn't inspire young people to actually come forward and participate in the political process, well, I don't know what will. But as far as the Conservatives are concerned, yes, you're right. The Lord's Chamber is just becoming bigger and bigger, and it's just completely full of Tory toffs.
Martin, Thangam, I'm assuming you've met her. Is she a Corbynista?
I don't think she is. I think she's actually more centrist within the political party than that.
So maybe she's hanging around to see which way...
I think virtually all MPs in the Labour Party were stunned by the Corbyn's victory. But I think times are changing.
I mean, the thing is that they become MPs in a process which was largely managed by Blairites.
Well, by Miliband.
Or candidates, yeah.
rather than Blairites. I think there are tensions within the Labour Party, because there should be, within a broad church party, which it is, there are going to be a spread of views. But I think the balance of power is shifting to the left, which is causing some problems for those on the right of the party who don't like that. But I think that's the mood of the membership, and the membership has massively increased as part of this process. And it just, for my mind, the Labour Party in New Zealand split in the 1980s over exactly the kind of issues we're disagreeing about.
Are you hoping the Labour Party will do the
same? No, I don't want it to split. But if it does split, the right will leave, as they did in New Zealand, and we will keep the union money. But, of course, when Corbyn came to speak in Bristol, I did put it to him, you need to commit to PR. That's an essential part of New Zealand
rugby.
Yeah,
but he's not, is he? I'm afraid you're not his special advisor, Martin.
No, he's not. But I think he should, because of that, of course, then... Because if some of the Blairites are talking of splitting the party and joining with the Liberal Democrats. Well, if they're going to do that, the Liberal Democrats will demand a commitment to PR from them.
Well, we must get Thangam on as soon as possible, especially since this radio station falls under her culture, media and sport remit. We better find out what her plans are for us if Labour get back in, and also what she's going to be saying, what are her priorities for the media, something that always bothers me. I mean, we were actually going to be talking to Nick Much, London journalist, who... in the second part of this show, who gave, and in fact worked over several weeks with the Daily Telegraph in the run-up to the general election, with a big expose of the Bullingdon Club, with a lot of old photos of Bullingdon Club people, which of course Boris Johnson, David Cameron, George Osborne were all members of this. And funnily enough, just a few days before the general election, they pulled the whole story. So the media is very powerful. It can make a lot of difference as to what is exposed and what isn't exposed about our most powerful people. And the Bullingdon Club being particularly interesting in that these were the people back in Victorian times that were running the country. It seems like they're now running it all over again. Anyway, look, on to another story. IVF first genetically modified human embryos could be created in Britain within weeks. Scientists are about to learn whether their research proposal has been approved by the fertility watchdog. Research involves editing of the genes of day-old IVF embryos. The first genetically modified human embryos could be created in Britain within weeks, according to the scientists who are about to learn whether their research proposal has been approved. What they're saying, Afzal, I'm not sure what you make of the idea of genetically modified children, a licence application to edit the genes of spare IVF embryos for research purposes only is to be discussed on the 14th of January by the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. Now, spare IVF embryos, that's like spare potential people. What do you make of this? Are they making a bit of a fuss about this, or should we be doing this as a part of our kind of technological future?
I think, given Britain's heritage, being at the cutting edge of science and technology, given the fact that DNA, the double helix, was actually discovered by British scientists, I think it's very important that this country, its scientists, and its technological organisations and universities are at the forefront. However, we need to be cautious. I can't profess that I know too much about this, but I do feel that we have to take one step at a time, and I think that the debate must be open, must be transparent, and I also feel that if need be, Keith Vaz, the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, needs to summon those at the cutting edge of this technology to ensure that whilst we do want to embrace technology, because look, if we don't do it, the Americans certainly will. I'm sure MIT, Stanford, these universities, Harvard, Princeton, or even the Chinese, the Germans, perhaps even in India, that they'll be throwing all their resources at this kind of technology. So we do want to be at the forefront, but I think that we have to take it one step at a time.
What about a human embryo? This is a human embryo, a little person about to happen. Is it okay to have designer babies? This is actually starting to smack a bit of eugenics, this kind of Nazi idea that we can breed better humans through genetic engineering and through special selection, and also, of course, looking at different types of embryos and saying as they're growing, this one we don't really want, this one, and so getting rid of them, exterminating them in the womb.
I think that it's very important that we do bear in mind that when we're talking about embryos, that there is a living, breathing individual, albeit that that they are still in fertilisation. However, I do remember that when we had the announcement about Dolly the sheep in Scotland, that there was a cry about Frankenstein medicine, Frankenstein science, and the kind of developments that it could lead to. In fact, there's a lot of positive things that have actually come out of that. So I think that we do need to separate fact from fiction, but we have to be cautious.
Martin, looking at the website of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, they were supposed to come to a decision about this yesterday. They haven't done so. It looks to me as if they've kicked this one into the long grass. What would you have done?
Well, as I say, as Afzal says, I haven't got a lot of a strong grasp on the technical aspects of this. And I'm looking at it here, it would be illegal to allow the embryos to live beyond 14 days. So what we're talking about is taking a human embryo, modifying it, and then allowing it to, basically letting it die. Now, in actual fact, I'm not in favour of abortion and saying that I like the idea of abortions. I think abortions are a sign of failure in society. But on the other hand, I do accept that abortions should be there for people. And if we're going to accept that, then we've already crossed that Rubicon of deciding that people are not going to be allowed to exist, even though they've been conceived. So we've already crossed that. We've already crossed that boundary.
Apart from the obvious attempts just to simply find out things for their own sake and possibly to help with medical advances. David King, director of the pressure group Human Genetics Alert, said this is the first step on a path that scientists have carefully mapped out towards the legalisation of genetically modified babies. Although we are always told the HFEA is there to make sure the crucial ethical lines are not crossed, in reality, HFEA exists precisely in order to manage and facilitate these transitions and to make sure the slope always stays slippery. So what he's saying effectively is there's going to be several stages to this, but eventually they're going to get there to design the babies.
Well, yes, I mean, the real problem is
where do you draw the line?
I mean, the real problem, in countries like India, for example, with ultrasound now, parents can tell whether it's a male or female child, but anybody can virtually do it with the technology that already exists. And because abortion is legal in India, they're now getting an imbalance between male and female populations, because girl babies are overwhelmingly more likely to be aborted than male babies.
Absolutely.
Now, that is social.
I'll give you the final word on this. Where do you draw the line? And should you draw the line? And if so, where?
Well, I think just as Martin has alluded to, that in terms of abortion globally, we have already crossed those lines. I feel that we really need far more information. I think that it's important that when we do have this debate, that all the MPs who are there at this debate, that they do understand the significance of this, and that they are accountable to their constituents. And I would say that anybody who feels very strongly about it, and I certainly, there's something that I'll be contacting my local MP, Thangham, about, and also one of my colleagues, Kerry, is to make sure that they understand the significance of this from the perspective of local residents, and also what next? Where exactly do we stop?
The trouble is, of course, that there could be a lot of money in this. If you have people saying, well, actually, I want my child to be like this, look like this, not to have these failings and faults, it could be a massive money spinner. That's what bothers me.
I was worried about this, actually, when they had the when they cracked the human genome in the States. I thought to myself that there will come a point when people, when the free market dictates that people want designer babies.
What about a designer baby that can live forever? That's one of the things that the Bilderberg and Google people have been looking at. They want to try and change the gene, take out genes that make people age, this kind of thing. This is some of the technology out there is getting pretty crazy. But anyway, look, from the world of designer babies and multi-million pound dollar eugenics to the real world. Prime Minister's Questions and Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron talking about housing in London.
Mr. Speaker, I noticed the Prime Minister did not give any guarantee to leaseholders on estates. And so there is another, probably larger group on most estates that I have a question to ask him on behalf of, a tenant by the name of Daryl, who says, will the Prime Minister guarantee that all existing tenants of the council estates earmarked for redevelopment will be rehoused in new council housing in their current communities with the same tenancy conditions as they currently have?
We're not going to be able to deal with these sink estates unless we get the agreement of tenants, unless we show how we're going to support homeowners, unless we show how we're going to support communities. But isn't it interesting, Mr. Speaker? Isn't it interesting, Mr. Speaker? Who here is the small C Conservative who's saying to people, stay stuck in your sink estates, have nothing better than what Labour gave you after the war? We're saying, if you're a tenant, have the right to buy. If you want to buy a home, here's help to save. If you're in a sink estate, we'll help you out. And that's the fact of politics today. A party on this side of the House that wants to give people life chances, and a Labour opposition that says, stay stuck in poverty.
Well, that's a pretty ridiculous stuff from Cameron there. I mean, it's quite straightforward. If your sink estate is going to be redeveloped and has been pointed out by the Prime Minister to be redeveloped, what sense would it make to buy your own council house in that estate, which is about to be knocked down? And it's perfectly legitimate people to ask, if you're going to knock our houses down where we live now and where we've always lived, what are you going to do with us? Oh, well, there's going to be affordable housing. Will we be able to afford it? The answer is no. So in other words, what we're talking about here is a land grab. You can imagine there are bigger estates in London, probably in Bristol as well, which if they were razed to the ground and rebuilt as private developments, could be very, very profitable for those involved. But the people who live there, they don't count for anything, do they?
That was one of the curious things about this Absal, is there wasn't any real talk in a lot of the commentary, for example, on the BBC, I saw, saying, well, what happens to the people when these places are redeveloped? And also, the very important point I thought Jeremy Corbyn raised there was about tenancies, because a lot of people are on good tenancies historically, which will allow them to stay there as long as they pay the rent. The landlords can't just get rid of them, and they have to give them good terms if they want them to move on somewhere and redevelop the place. But no mention of that in these government proposals at all.
No, it doesn't really surprise me. And certainly, if you look at Bristol, and if you look at the mayor selling the land at the port, that could have been used to get some of the people off the so-called sink estates in Avonmouth, in Lawrence Weston, which is right on the doorstep. So I think that the Prime Minister is actually very disingenuous talking about sink estates. And what has David Cameron actually done to address deprivation in these estates over the last few years? I mean, all the indicators seem to show that social mobility and unemployment is becoming a greater challenge in this country. So you have to look at the bigger picture. You can't just look at housing on its own in isolation. I think that social mobility is becoming increasingly harder for working class people. And Bristol, along with Brighton, it was reported this week, have suffered the highest rates of rent in the whole of England. So I just feel that David Cameron could and should be doing far more to actually tackle this. And just as Martin said, it is all about a land grab and it's about increased gentrification. You can see that locally here in Easton.
Give us some examples. Where?
Well, for example, if you look at Greenbank, right next to the chocolate factory, you've got properties there on the market for £350,000. Three-bedroom terrace properties right next to Easton, in inner-city areas in Bristol. I mean, who can afford that? What, three times salary? Yeah, even if you had a £50,000 deposit to put down, who's earning £100,000?
Martin, I retweeted a tweet with some expletives in it this week, which was based on the Daily Politics programme with Andrew Neil on the BBC, where they were talking about this, and a basic price in London now of a one-bedroom flat, they were talking about £450,000.
It was the Andrew Marr show, I think, rather than the Andrew Neil show, and they had Squeeze, the old band, on there, and they actually changed one of their lyrics. They changed one of their lyrics to attack exactly this policy, because they said, I was brought up in a council house, and that my mum lived in a council house all her life. It gave us security. It allowed me to get a job as a pop star, whatever. And I wasn't really intending to do it, but when I heard him coming out with it on the show, I decided I'd change the lyrics. I've read he wrote an article about it for The Guardian as well. I mean, housing policy in this country is a disgrace, frankly. It was pretty bad before.
People who've gone on the ladder 20, 30 years ago are starting to make lots of money out of this. But nobody else, or very few people, especially even young couples, both of whom are working, can actually get enough money together for a deposit and to regularly pay a mortgage off. And it's basically, I mean, in London, apparently, on average, it's taking two-thirds of everybody's salary is just simply going on their housing.
Well, I'm in that position, Tony, here in Bristol. That's the reality. I think that there's...
At what point does it break, though?
Well, it'll break because the property market's going to burst.
But it's going to go down the drain. Actually, landlords know it can never break because everybody needs a home and it's your number one priority. Most of the money in your life you will spend on your home.
Yeah, well, what happens when you get a property crash is that the people the people who got on the property ladder at the bottom, they will lose out. But, of course, the Duke of Westminster, who's the biggest landowner in Britain...
Well, he got on the property ladder about 700 years ago.
Yeah, he got on the property ladder in in 1066 or whatever, they are in a position to make money out of these cycles of boom and bust. And it's a racket.
Okay,
an absolute racket. So and it doesn't happen in other parts of
Europe. Why is the Labour Party not articulating this and making it clear what's going on? A racket.
The new leadership of the Labour Party is pretty clear. I understand that we are committed to building council homes, are we not, Afzal?
Yes,
that is the policy.
Affordable social housing. But also here in Bristol, I think it's scandalous that Bristol City Council, although with any development that takes place, for example, with the chocolate factory here in Easton, we are supposed to have 30% affordable social housing. Now, if you look at Westmoreland House and Stokes Croft, 9% social housing. What's all that about? Yet, as far as the mayor is concerned, that represents good value. That is something that he supported. And I just feel that if you're saying that your local policy for affordable housing is 30%, stick with 30%. That's certainly what I'm trying to do with the with Generator Group, the chocolate factory here in Greenbank. And I'll be taking it to the planning committee and saying that unless they commit to 30%, refuse it.
Yeah. And the other thing, of course, is if you vote for the Labour Party at the coming May elections, what we're really trying to do is change national policy, something that George Ferguson simply can't do. He's just got to sit there and soak up whatever London throws at him. But we're not just in the business of running Bristol.
But also, I think that, you know, David Cameron has paid lip service to saying that he'll be tackling fraud, because, as we know, a lot of the money that's pushing up property prices in London is coming from very dubious sources, from Russia, it's come from the Qataris, come from the Saudis. Don't necessarily know the origins of that money. Okay, some of it is from sovereign wealth funds, but we need the process to be a lot more accountable and to actually see traceability of those funds coming in. Mm. And why do we need, you know, London's property prices to go so high, make people feel that it's completely unaffordable?
All this quantitative easing money's got to go somewhere. Mm. Why not into housing?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why this happens is because it suits certain vested interests. I mean, it's what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England, and it actually has big impacts on the macroeconomic policy of the country, because these property bubbles, which are endemic in Britain, lead to a situation where you have to raise interest rates to choke off the property bubble, and that means that everything north of the Wash is not flat in terms of, you know, it actually starves resources from small and medium enterprises.
I mean, one of the things David Cameron is saying here is that there will be a right to buy. He wants people to own their own homes, and Matt Fish in The Independent wrote a terrific article, I thought. It headlines, Cameron's talk of sink estates at Prime Minister's Questions hides the reality behind council housing in the UK. He says, critics of right to buy are well documented, but what Cameron fails to acknowledge is that even owning one's own home on an estate isn't a guarantee that it won't be subject to a compulsory purchase order once its location falls prey to deliberate and target demonisation that preempts its demolition. He cites the former Haygate estate in the Elephant and Castle in South London as just one case in point. Formerly one of the largest social housing projects in Europe, it was home to thousands, a large number of whom disagreed with its nefarious depiction as problematic sink estate. Widely praised for its green spaces and innovative architecture, many argued in favour of its refurbishment, but it was nevertheless decanted, in inverted commas, and finally demolished last year to make way for largely for private apartments.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what this is all about. That if you look at the spatial fix in Britain, cities like Bristol and London would have social housing, council housing, cheek by jowl with relatively affluent private housing, and that was done through zoning and planning regulations and everything. We can move to a situation like the US, where the wealthy side of town and the poor side of town are two completely separate places. Completely separate.
No, that's what the free market certainly wants. Seems to be where we're going. Anyway, on to the water's story this week. Private water companies are earning billions via rip-off charges. MPs are accusing Ofwat of failure to ensure fairness for their poorest customers. Britain's privatised water companies have made windfall profits of over £1 billion because government regulators have allowed them to change, charge customers unnecessarily high prices, MPs have found. Of course, we had Chris Curling from the Merchant Venturers and from Bristol Water on here last year talking about this very subject just after Ofwat reported on them. A report from the Parliament's Public Accounts Committee accused Ofwat, the water regulator, of consistently overestimating water companies' financing and tax costs when setting price limits. As a result, the water companies made gains of at least £1.2 billion over the last 5 years from bills being cranked up. Among those worst hit have been the poorest customers, funnily enough. What a great success this privatisation has been, isn't it? Also, looking more locally, in the Bristol Post, they did a story on Wednesday about this. Patrick Daly, the parliamentary correspondent, and he said Ofwat defended itself by saying it had twice called for Bristol Water, which is responsible for the city's water supply, while Wessex Water is in charge of sewage, to cut its prices in the last 6 years. In 2014, it called on the city's water supply to cut prices by 19%, a decision which was appealed. So they're spending more of our bill money on lawyers to try and say, no, we don't want to be regulated, with adjudicators bringing it down to 16%, so they probably got their value for money there. Chiefs at the water company wanted to take a hit of just 6%. Karen Smith, MP for Bristol South, sits on the committee and said her constituents could rightly feel aggrieved at the shortcomings. She said the privatised water companies have made a great deal of money because customers' bills have been higher than they needed to be. Unlike gas, electric and broadband, householders don't have the choice to shop around for a better deal on water supply. So Ofwat's role is absolutely vital. Many people will look at this and think, as far as they're concerned, Ofwat had one job and they didn't do it properly. They'll rightly feel aggrieved and consider Ofwat has sold them short. Now, AFSAL, we all need water. Again, it's a bit like housing, isn't it? It's one of those basic things. And these people have been ripping us off. And actually, Bristol, here at Bristol Water, they've been spending the money that they've used after ripping us off to pay lawyers to actually rip us off a little bit more rather than what Ofwat are saying.
But I think it's important to bear in mind that it's not like they produce the water. All they do is simply
actually, I suppose they could sit there and do nothing and the water would kind of carry on gushing through. What they're saying is they need massive amounts of investment, and Ofwat have said, no, you don't.
Well, I think as far as the government is concerned and the regulatory bodies, that if they've said 19%, so I think that they need far more teeth and also start fining them. So we can see that whether it's water, privatisation of water, the utilities, whether it's privatisation of the railways, it's been a complete failure. Just several days earlier, my colleagues were at the protest of the railways. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it. It's now proven that this country has one of the most expensive railway systems globally, and people just can't afford it. So there's even more pressure on people, as well as paying for rent, as well as paying for water, for utilities. I mean, it's fine for us here, sitting in a nice warm studio, but you think about how many people who've had water meters fitted, how they've been ripped off. Think about the elderly people out there here in Eastern and other parts of Bristol who can't afford to warm their homes up because it's freezing cold. It's going to be a freezing cold night tonight. People are being ripped off left, right and centre, and this government is responsible for the privatisation of these utilities.
Martin, water, we all need it, don't we? So surely this has got to be managed and it's got to be supplied at cost. One of the things that's most disturbing about this is that the poorest customers have been hardest hit. Maybe they're aware that the rich, wealthy customers may be more guaranteed to pay, and so the water companies think, well, we're going to have to charge people a bit more because they may not be paying their bills even.
Well, the case for these industries to be in the public sector is overwhelming, which is why Scottish Water is still run by the Scottish Government. And even Welsh Water is a not-for-profit company. And, of course, the other thing is that you're supposed to charge people at the margin. Now, the real cost of water is not the actual amount of water you consume, it's how expensive it is to connect you to the main supply. And in actual fact, big mansions in the country which have to have an extra main put in, they cost far more to supply than a tower block in Easton. So in actual fact, it ought to be cheaper in big cities than it is in the country. But that would be unfair. So, in actual fact, people are charged per litre that
they consume. Hang on. What about in a city? Why couldn't the water supply be free? Pay for it in general
taxation? In Ireland, until very recently, all water was provided free. And under part of the austerity measures, the government has tried to charge people for water for the first time ever.
I don't know.
Actually provoked the biggest protests in the Irish Republic since independence. Similar things have been seen in developing countries. In Bolivia, for example, in La Paz, they tried to privatise the water supply and insist that people couldn't even collect rainwater. It led to a massive popular mobilisation and the kicking out of the neoliberal
government. Talking of which, maybe the only thing Bristol Water would listen to is if people right across the city got together and just refused to pay their bills. That may be the only thing they'll listen to, because they certainly seem to throw lawyers at everything and rather than actually do what they're being told to by the regulators. Anyway, staying with water for a bit, householders affected by floods face insurance double whammy if they live nearby fracking sites. Now, DEFRA are also saying fracking also causes a 10% fall in your value of your home, yet there's very little you can do about it. If a fracking company now decides it wants to do some fracking, they just get to do it, and there's not a lot you can do about it. Even local authorities are finding it now difficult to stop the fracking. But this is the latest I've heard. The amazing thing I've heard is that because of the chemicals and things that get into the water due to fracking, you can't get insurance against flooding in many of these places.
My heart absolutely goes out to those individuals put into these precarious situations. And I think that we need to question the need for fracking, given that at the moment the cost per barrel of oil is, and I'm sure Martin will correct me if I'm wrong,
about $30
per barrel. Yeah, it's about $30 per barrel. So I don't understand what the wisdom is between by the current government giving licenses to fracking companies to actually go and extract shale gas. Rarely have the commodities, oil and gas, been so cheap. But I completely agree with you that for no reason of their own, people find themselves uninsured. And we've seen the harrowing images of people who have lost so much up north.
And just a bit of news from the United States. I noticed just over the last 24 hours, there's been an enormous earthquake in one of the fracking zones in the United States, where they've now, the US government said no, they're going to have to absolutely stop any fracking in there for the foreseeable future.
Well, I mean, the fracking industry could be the thing that brings down the global financial system, because in the US, the fracking companies are heavily overborrowed. They've got, you know,
so there's sort of big promises made.
Yeah,
about this,
they're very. It's very capital intensive, so they've had to borrow an awful lot of money to sink these wells. And of course, with the oil price where it is now, and see, the problem now is that the supply and demand mechanism doesn't work. Oil price goes down, and instead of cutting back, Saudi Arabia and Russia are increasing, because it becomes a game of chicken. And that's just because the free market, you know, the theory in the textbook that if the price goes down, they'll stop producing. That doesn't happen. It's like Chinese steel. Chinese steel is uneconomic, but they don't stop producing it because you've already invested huge amount
steel,
in building the steel mills.
Steel price is gone through the floor. The oil price is going through the floor. This is the real world commodities, isn't it?
Well, it is. And
whereas the stock market is carrying on.
Oh, yes, and the Baltic Dry Index, which is the price you have to pay to hire a ship to move stuff, is at the lowest ever it's ever been this week. And another thing,
haven't we heard about that?
Well, no, because it's not a good news
it's
story,
is it? A massively
the
important
the other thing, well, the other thing which I picked up on the internet this week is, did you realise that there is not one single ship crossing the Atlantic with stuff in as we speak? Not crossing from the US to Europe, and not crossing from Europe to the US. In other words, the whole of the global trading system is literally grinding to a halt as we speak.
Well,
But the stock market is just wobbling a bit, but it's going to stop wobbling a bit, and it's going to go through the floor very shortly, and then Jeremy Corbyn's going to look like a moderate compared to what comes after that.
And then we'll see what happens with house prices, not only in London but in the provinces.
Well,
there'll be a big crash, but the big people will still be better off. It's the small people who pick up the tap.
So this is what bothers me, is the big guys always stand to make money out of these disasters. Let's go back to talk about Bristol again now. And it's an interview now. We're going to hear an excerpt from with Christine Townsend, who's standing as an independent candidate for mayor, and been looking at very closely at our education system. The whole point, really, of having a chat to her on our dialect show earlier this week, which is not on BCFM at the moment, we're hoping it's going to be back as soon as possible, but you can listen to it online at dialectradio.co.uk every week. It's got a bit longer since we went on to the podcast, because we're not having to squeeze it into just an hour, but it's definitely well worth listening to. And this is an extract from that, where Christine is talking about what would happen in Bristol, which I found absolutely fascinating, if schools were forced to take local children. At the moment, they are doing quite a lot of selection, these academy schools. They're given a lot of leeway to do what they want. But if they were forced to take children just from the local areas, what the picture of education in the city would look like?
Redland Green would pretty much stay as it is, because it's in an affluent, very affluent area. But other than that, I would suggest that actually we'd have a much better mix, because if we look at where the schools are geographically located in Bristol that have small numbers of children entitled to free school meals, that is St Bede's, which is in Lawrence Weston, tiny numbers of children entitled to free school meals. St Bernadette's in Withywood, same, it's tiny numbers of children entitled to free school meals. St Mary Redcliffe, as I've just said. Colston Girls, which is on the edge of Ashley Ward. Cathedral, right in the middle of Bristol. And the Free School, which is on the edge of Southmead. And the other one is at Ashton Park. So it might not work across the whole of the country for local kids to go to local schools, but in Bristol it would make a massive difference because of geographically where our schools are located.
Afsal, what Christine's saying there effectively is that some of our best performing schools are actually in some of the poorer areas. So if they were forced just to take local children, families, parents, kids of those parents would actually be getting a better education for their children. What they're doing, it seems, is a lot of the better schools, so-called better schools, they're cherry-picking who they want to be in that school.
They are cherry-picking, and I think that's extremely unfortunate. If you look at City Academy here, 85% of the children who attend this school are on free school meals. And if you look at, say, a Cathedral, 4% of the children there are on free school meals. So the huge disparity, and how far, just within 2 mile radius of the schools from one another. So I think that Sir David Carter, who's the Regional Schools Commissioner, he's now the National Schools Commissioner, I think that he needs to sit down and he needs to start talking to the local authority with local schools, and we need to have a conversation about how we can make sure that the schools are being a lot more inclusive. I think this is about
Final story. Cancer patients could be left homeless because of brutal Tory benefit cuts. This is from the Mirror. Desperately ill patients battling cancer face being made homeless for the latest cruel Tory cuts. The charities warn Macmillan Cancer Support says the government cuts to employment and support allowance will leave thousands of people with cancer £30 a week worse off, and for many of them they simply cannot afford to pay the rent, Martin.
Look, got to get realistic, Tony. Those bankers need their bonuses. They've got private school fees to pay, foreign holidays, skiing holidays. That's got to be the priority, hasn't it? Let's face it.
Afsal?
Completely agree. Sorry. I'm just laughing at what Tony said. It is about prioritisation, and I think they're right. They have to pay for the next skiing holiday to the Rockies or in Val d'Isère. Why should they care about the poor people in the city who are
feeling deprived? Terry White, 62, from Nottinghamshire, was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma in 2009. He said, "I'd worked hard as an electrician 7 years before my diagnosis had brought my dream family home. But now he's in the situation where he's having to sell his home, even though he's got cancer anyway." Thanks to our guest, Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. After the news, it's Kroll.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile.